Is that weird when you're praying and somebody's moving around right next to you? He knew I was coming. It'd be weird if not. But I got to get all my stuff set up here this morning. Good morning. How are you? Good. It's really good to see you. I have not seen you in a long time. I have not been here in a long time. So it's really, really excellent to see you. And it's great to share the word with you. And I'm going to jump right in this morning, if that's okay. There's a really powerful moment. We study Jesus here, right? Is that who we study? I hope so. Have you study Jesus? And there's this really powerful moment in the life of Jesus when he is with his disciples. And it's in the book of Luke. If you want to check this later, it's in Luke chapter 6. And Jesus goes up onto the mountaintop to pray. You know, he's trying to catch the vision of the Father. And this, you know, Scott just talked about vision. We pray. We try to say, God, where are you leading us? And God says, the Father says some things to Jesus. He comes down. He calls his disciples. And then Luke says that there's these people that gather around him from all kinds of places, all different towns, all different stripes, you know, people with that need healing and all these kind of things. And Jesus says these powerful words as he's kind of beginning his ministry. And he says this. He says, listen closely, love your enemies, do good to those that hate you, bless those that curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on the cheek, turn to them the other also. If somebody takes your coat, don't withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks of you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, don't ask for it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. It's funny, we love to tell our kids that one, but not all the other ones, right? Interesting. Love your enemies. Do good to them and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge. Do not condemn. Forgive. Be generous. And then he says this. You've heard this one probably before. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. Ouch. First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Does that hurt anybody besides me this morning? Like, I'm listening to that list, and I remember Jesus says that following him is the narrow way. It's the hard way. There's a narrow gate, and only a few find it. Those are tough words, aren't they? They're very similar to the ones that are spoken in the Sermon on Mount captured in Matthew. I think it's probably the same thing, and Luke records it a little differently than Matthew does. Now, let me just tell you, I'm going to start with me this morning. I'm going to tell you what happens to me when I read those words. I'm going to tell you what happens in my heart. I'm just going to be honest with you this morning. This happens often when I read the Bible, is that other people come to mind, right? I read those words and other people immediately come to mind. I deflect those words because I don't want to hear them from my own heart. I want to think about other people. It's kind of like, you know, it's interesting because Jesus is saying, don't judge lest you be judged. And I'm like, yeah, those people shouldn't judge. I immediately flip into what he tells me not to do. It's kind of like there's this story of Jesus tells another time of a religious man who's standing in public and he's praying, and there's another, it's called a publican, I love that word. He's praying and he's kind of in private and he's, oh, woe is me. And the man standing in public is like, oh, God, I'm really glad I'm not like that guy. And to be honest, if I'm really honest with myself, I have a tremendous propensity to focus on other people's sins, on other people's problems, even when God is trying to get through to me. And these words, echoing through what we call the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is saying that there's something that matters in your heart. And each of these moments is a bit of a crisis moment, right? There's something happened in this moment. And I think what Jesus is getting at is that a person's true character comes out in crisis. Now, I don't have to tell you that this last year has been a year of interesting crisis, right? It's just been a really, really interesting year. And I have noticed something about my heart. If true character comes out in the midst of crisis, then I have some work to do. I don't know about you, but it's been really easy for me over this last year, more than a year now, to point the finger at other people and say, why are they doing what they're doing? I can't understand what they're doing. They're missing the point. They're missing the mark. If there's anything that my unhealthy and sinful self felt drawn to in 2020, it was looking at other people and judging them. And I fall right into this column that Jesus is talking about. And so those words for me, I'm just talking about me right now. Those words for me cut me like a knife. You see, Jesus is inviting me to look into my own heart and to be self-reflective. But instead, I get a little bit like Captain America. You know Captain America? And he's got that amazing shield. You know, made of, what is it made of? Can't remember. Some amazing metal. And he deflects everything with that thing. Bullets, you know, everything. I'm a little bit like that. The words of Jesus come at me and I've got Captain America shield and I just deflect them. Instead of listening to the words, I become self-protective and deflective. And I'm not proud of it. Believe me, this isn't a fun thing to tell you. But I don't think I'm alone either. I don't think I'm alone. There were so many times this past year when I caught myself saying in my heart, can you believe those people? One of my struggles has been to pay attention to my own judgmentalism when Jesus is calling me to prayer. When Jesus is calling me to grace, when Jesus is calling me to generosity, to forgiveness, to mercy, I found myself challenged over this past year. And honestly, I've been sitting in Luke 6 for about 6 months. This is why I bring it to you this morning. I'm not going to bring you something that I haven't been wrestling with myself. You remember this aphorism that when you're pointing to someone else, you have right at least three fingers pointing back to yourself? It's kind of true, isn't it? And that's kind of what Jesus is getting at through this whole passage, and we just miss it. But the words of Jesus catch me here, and I want to ask you this morning. Now, I talked about me. I am going to invite you into this. I want to ask, what about you this morning? Is anything I said about myself true about you, or is it just me? If it's just me, we can do a group therapy session for me today. That would be okay. But I'm guessing I'm not the only one in the room who moves towards deflection instead of towards self-reflection. You see, Jesus uses an interesting back and forth here. He says, not this, but this. Not hate, but love. Not condemnation, but forgiveness. Not grudges, but generosity and mercy. Not judgment, but self-awareness. Not deflection, but reflection. You see, Jesus is inviting you into a more beautiful, wonderful, amazing life. He's saying all these other things, the things that my heart and maybe your heart immediately tips to, are things that destroy us from the inside out. There's sicknesses inside of our heart. And Jesus says, I don't want you to live like that. Do you know when you give into those things, it hurts your heart? One of the things I find really interesting is our human propensity towards bias, right? We have these biases, these things that we focus on that we see the world through a lens. And psychologists have a couple of different types of biases that they talk about. I want to tell you about two of them this morning that are about our human tendencies to be biased against others instead of ourselves or in favor of ourselves, okay? Kind of what Jesus is talking about in this section. The first one's called the actor-observer bias. Now, some of you are like, oh, I'm so sick of psychology. I'm in this sophomore class and, you know, whatever. But let's just pay attention to this for a minute because it's really interesting. The actor-observer bias is this. It's a tendency to find blame for our own actions in external causes, but blame for other people's behaviors from internal causes. Let me give you a little explanation of that. It's like we do something wrong and it's somebody else's fault, right? Somebody catches us in something or they challenge our behavior or something. And but you know what? It's that other person's problem. But if somebody else does something wrong, it's something wrong with them or with their behavior. For instance, if I lose my job, there's some sort of injustice in it. But if somebody else loses their job, certainly they did something wrong, right? They were a bad worker. They didn't show up on time, you know, whatever. If I get angry with someone, I'm justified in my anger because somebody did something to make me angry. But if somebody else gets angry, they're out of line. You see what I'm saying here? We have a tremendous ability to see fault outside of ourselves except for in other people. And this kind of bias plays a huge role in how we perceive and interact with everybody, from our family to our coworkers to our neighbors, anybody. Essentially, we make different judgments based on whether we're the actor or the observer. When we're the actors, we easily dismiss our own guilt and we commute our own sentence. But when someone else is the actor, we're the judge and jury right away, right? This is what psychologists talk about anyway. Now, Jesus didn't get his master's in social psychology, but he knew a lot about the human psyche, didn't he? Jesus seemed to just know people's hearts and minds, and he was saying things 2,000 years ago that psychologists are just starting to figure out. A second one is called confirmation bias. And in confirmation bias, we look for evidence that confirms what we already think and believe, and we ignore evidence to the contrary. Right? These are the lenses through which we see the world. So if we think or believe that those kind of people are such and such, then we look for behaviors that prove our point, and you know you're going to find it. And if you believe yourself to be kind and generous and wonderful and good, you're going to find behaviors about yourself to confirm the bias about yourself. If we think our spouse is selfish, or the neighbor kid is naughty, or the boss is kind of a jerk, then of course we're going to find behaviors. We're going to find times that prove our point, right? But if any of those things are true of us, it was circumstantial or it was somebody else's. We exonerate ourselves. You see, our belief about ourselves and about others become self-fulfilling prophecies because we ignore those things that challenge our pre-existing biases. Years ago, I think 10 years ago now, I read a book by a really good Christian psychologist. His name is Henry Cloud. He's written the book Boundaries. Maybe you've read some of those books. He's written some really great books. And he said in this book something that just struck me. He said, so many of us end up disappointing others in major ways because we fail to see the truth about ourselves in minor ways. Let me say that again. We often end up disappointing others in major ways because we fail to see the truth about ourselves in minor ways. And those things build over time and they become patterns in our life. Because honesty about ourselves can be difficult. It can be difficult. So, I already brought you to Jesus. I'm going to bring you to the Old Testament now, okay? I want to give you a story that helps me understand this and challenges me a little bit further. I'm going to crack this open a little bit further. One of my favorite Bible verses, 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 7. You are the man. You are the man. You know, I want you to say, Tom, you were the man. No, don't do that. I'm kidding. Did you know you can take Bible verses out of context? We do it all the time, don't we? That's just a really good example. We like to take other ones out of context all the time, but we don't pay attention. But this one, if you took it out of context, it's really interesting. I'm going to read to you, and I just want you to listen to the story. I'm going to read to you the context that this comes out of in 2 Samuel chapter 12. And I'm going to read it from the Message Bible, which is a little more of a paraphrase. Just listen to the story. It's not going to come up on the screen. God was not pleased with something that David had done and sent Nathan, his friend, to David. Nathan said to him, there were two men in the same city, one rich, the other poor. The rich man had huge flocks of sheep and herds of cattle. The poor man had nothing but one little female lamb, which he had bought and raised himself. It grew up with him and his children as a member of their family. We call that a pet today. It ate off his plate and it drank from his cup and it slept in his bed. It was like a daughter to him. One day a traveler dropped in on the rich man. He was too stingy to take an animal from his own herds or flocks to make a meal for his visitor. So he took the poor man's lamb. We'll say pet. He took the poor man's pet and prepared a meal to set before his guest. Now, Nathan is telling the story to his friend David, right? I started telling you about that. And God was upset because of something David had done. David wasn't just any friend of Nathan's. David is also the king of Israel, and he's a pretty successful king, and he had a lot of power, and he had a lot of money, and to this day, it's David's star that's on the flag of Israel. David is known by many of us as a man after God's own heart. You know, David is that's this David. And Nathan comes to David and tells him this story. And David responds, right? Because, I mean, who wouldn't be upset at this story, right? David exploded in anger. As surely as God lives, he said to Nathan, the man who did this ought to be killed. He must repay the lamb four times over for his crime and stinginess. Or, as it says in the NIV, David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. You see, David is angry because he's the observer in the story. Remember the actor observer? He's looking at someone else and he hears the story and he says, that's not just. That man ought to die. He sees the injustice and he is incensed. How could the rich man do that to the poor man? Especially when this thing is like a pet to that man and to his family. This man must be punished. Now Nathan knew David because he's his friend. And Nathan knew that if he confronted David on his sin. Now here, David had made a huge mistake, a huge sin. David had had an affair with a woman named Bathsheba. Not only that, she had gotten pregnant, and then he hid the whole thing, and he killed her husband, who was a general in his army. And Nathan knew that David was powerful, and David saw himself as good. And Nathan knew that if he came to him, that David would have his Captain America shield up, and he would deflect anything that came to him. So Nathan is brilliant, and he tells him this story because he loves him as a friend, and Nathan loves him enough to address it. Nathan doesn't pretend it's not happening. Right? Nathan doesn't just say, well, not my issue, because this is his friend. And God asks him to confront his friend, and this is where that verse in 12:7 comes from. You are the man. You're the man. David, you're the rich man. David, you're the unjust man. David, you're the one who sinned in this story. David, you're the one who's stolen from the poor man when you have everything. David, you're the one who has acted unjustly. You see, this reminds me of the words of Jesus. Reminds me of the words of Jesus. Numerous times throughout the New Testament, Jesus says a couple of things. So one of the things he says often is he says, blessed are those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. Right? Maybe you've heard that before. Blessed are those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. Before hearing this story, David didn't have eyes to see or ears to hear. Jesus also says this. This is from Mark 4. He says, they are ever seeing, but never perceiving, and ever hearing, but never understanding. You see, Jesus knows us so well. We don't perceive what's happening often in our own hearts. We are blinded to our own behavior and our own words, and we exonerate ourselves and we justify ourselves just like David. See, David's no different than me, and I think he's probably no different than you. And often we don't even know why we do what we do, right? Sometimes we exonerate ourselves because we don't know why we act the way we do. There's something. Have you ever had this happen? I'll talk about me again. We'll just do that. Something happens. And I react in anger. I react. I get defensive. Afterwards I go, what on earth was that about? Like I actually don't even know why I reacted the way I reacted. Did you ever have that? Something happens and we use this language, it pushes our buttons. I don't know with David. David, did you know David had 7 wives before this occurrence? And none of them went well? Something's going on inside of David. Is it insecurities? Is it lack of intimacy in those first 7 marriages? What's going on? And you know, he had all these problems with his kids, like broken relationships with his kids. David had all these things. What's going on inside David? I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. I can't read David's heart, but something's going on inside of him that causes him to sin. Now, that doesn't exonerate his sin. It's still sin. It is still wrong. It is still destructive. But David probably doesn't have a clue why he's even doing it. And so David, after this, gets cut to the heart because Nathan gets in behind his biases and challenges him, and David sees himself. And maybe or maybe not, I don't know, maybe you've seen or heard Psalm 51. David writes Psalm 51 after this experience. I just want to read it to you because David all of a sudden begins to have eyes to see and ears to hear. He says this. He says, oh, have mercy on me, God. According to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Transgressions are sins. You know, make them go away. Wash away all my iniquity. Again, sin. Cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, my sins, where I've crossed over. My sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. David begins to see in his heart. Now, I am not here to make you feel bad. So if you're feeling bad, that's not, like, I'm not here to make you feel guilty. I'm not here to talk about the speck in your eye. I'm here to share with you that there's another way to live that Jesus invites you into that's richer, fuller, more honest, more beautiful, and more human the way we were intended to be. Because we live in a world that practices deflection, but Jesus invites us instead into a life of reflection. Okay, we all have our shields. Jesus says, put down the shield. You can trust me, Jesus says. Oh, it'll hurt a little bit, but it'll be good. It'll be good surgery on your heart. Let me say it this way. Instead of the world, let's personalize it. We practice deflection. But Jesus invites us instead to self-reflection. You see, Jesus invites you and I on a different path. I said it from the beginning, the narrow path. He invites us through the narrow gate, and he wants us to live as strangers in this culture. Jesus wants you and I to live counterculturally. And it is okay for you to live in this world and to talk about those other people and not to look in your own heart. But Jesus says, that's not my way. My way is to look at yourself and to work on that with me and to find out what is that dysfunction in your heart? What is that pain in your heart that's causing you to sin? You're responsible for your sin. But let's get inside and let's take a look at what's in there. Long time ago, I began to see a Christian counselor, Christian therapist. And on and off throughout my life, I have had a Christian therapist that I've gone to. And when I began to do that, I began to ask the question, help me understand what's going on in my heart. I want to know why I do some of the things that I do that are not the way of Jesus. And I began to realize that certain situations and certain people in my life tapped into something deep and unmet and hurts deep down inside of me. And when I began to see those, instead of reacting, I was able to look at them and then make a choice. And so if I react, I'm going to react in sin. But if I see this, Jesus gives me another way to live. And I can. There's freedom in that. I also began to realize that, surprise, surprise, there are sides of me that people see that I don't see. Things I'm blind to. And you're like, I know. We all have blind spots, right? Every car has a blind spot. We bought a new minivan this year, and one of the first things that my wife did was, before we bought it, she said, I want to drive it because I want to see where the blind spots are, because some cars I just can't, the blind spots are too weird, right? Well, we all have those kind of blind spots, and you can't just decide to see your blind spots. You need mirrors. Nathan was a mirror to David. We all need mirrors in our lives. When I went to that therapist, I began to invite mirrors into my life, not just with the therapist, but with my friends, and saying, what do you see in me? Help me to see those things. I want to see my blind spots. I want to lean into what Jesus says. They are ever hearing, but never, or ever hearing, but never listen, ever listen, whatever it is. I can't get it right. Seeing, but not perceiving. I know that one. We have ears to hear, but we don't really hear. We have eyes to see, but we don't really see. So let's get practical. In this series, we've been talking about practices. So I want to talk about practices. I want to get very practical with you about this. So I'm going to give you two things that I want to draw you into. The first practice is to let someone that you trust and who loves you hold up the mirror. David had a good friend that he trusted enough to hold up the mirror. Now, David had the power, he had the influence, and he'd done it before. He could have killed Nathan and covered the whole thing up, right? But he didn't. He trusted Nathan. He knew that Nathan loved him. He knew that even if Nathan spoke the truth in love, that it would be in love and that Nathan had his best in mind. So I don't know who that is. It could be a good friend. Could be a kind of a soul friend. Could be a professional, a therapist, a counselor. Could be a spouse. Could be someone from church here that you just get connected with and say, I want to meet regularly with you and talk through some things. We need to wrestle with people. Let me read you. I read this, actually. I was reading this book having nothing to do with this sermon, and I came across this this week, I think Wednesday. Let me just read it to you. It's from a book by Henry Nouwen. He says, we are all susceptible to self-deception and are not always able to detect our own fearful games or blind spots? How do we know that we are not deluding ourselves? That we are not selecting words of Scripture that best fit our passions, or that we are not just listening to the voice of our own imagination? Who can judge their own heart? Who can determine if their feelings and insights are leading them in the right direction? It is easy to make our heart's desires and our mind's speculations into the will of God. Whew, that hurts. We need someone who helps us to distinguish between the voice of God and the other voices coming out of our own confusion or from dark powers beyond our control. We need someone who encourages us when we are tempted to give it all up, to forget it all, and just to walk away in despair. We need someone who cautions us when we move too rashly in clear directions or hurry proudly toward a nebulous goal. We need someone who can suggest to us when to read and when to be silent, which words to reflect on, and what to do when silence creates much fear and little peace. We need someone. Is there anyone in your life? Is there anyone in your life who can speak the truth to you in love that you can trust? That you don't react to when they hold up to the mirror? Someone who can speak the truth in love to you, who can help you, you can trust them to sift through those old memories or those secret places that you don't want to share with anybody, the scars, the wounds. Someone who can hold up the mirror and enter into your heart and help you do the delicate surgery, or even better, to let Jesus do the delicate surgery once you see what's there. Is there someone in your life who can help you do the work of opening your eyes to see what you can't see, to help you unstop your ears to hear what you can't hear? A Nathan that loves you enough to tell you the truth. So here's the practical part. If you don't have that person, you, Henry Nolan's right, need someone. You need someone. I will not back off that. You need someone who can speak the truth in love to you. You probably need multiple people. And here's very practical things to do. Give them permission. Give them permission to speak truth into your life. And then put time aside to process your life, your words, your behavior with them. Talk with them about what's happening. Pray together. Listen to the words of God together. And then speak words of blessing and goodness over one another. Words of Jesus, the words of the Father. And then pursue transformation in your hearts together. You need someone. Now, I understand. You may not know where to start. Maybe you've been like, you know, I'll talk to guys because I'm a guy. I don't understand women. Never will. Just kidding. Men, often we can take care of ourselves, right? You need someone. Stop it. Your wife will tell you. You need someone. You need someone to open your heart to open your life to. How do you do that, though? Well, you can hire somebody. You can hire a therapist or a counselor. You can get a spiritual director. Those are two great ways. You can go to that friend that you've always trusted, that's always been, and just be vulnerable with them. It's going to take a vulnerable step for you. It's just going to take that. Another way is to ask us. Ask us. We're here for you. We will help you do that. We will find you somebody in this church or outside of this church. We will be that person for you. We want to walk with you in this journey. You need someone. Okay, the second practice is the practice of actual self-examination. So first you've got a person. You've got to allow them into your life to speak truth to you. But I want you to use your imagination for this one, okay? Self-examination, and we're going to talk about prayer of self-examination, okay? But first I want you to imagine, use your imagination. I want you to imagine your inner life as a special space deep inside of you that no one else has access to unless you let them in. This room has a particular character that's yours and yours alone. This inner room is a place out of which you live your life, whether you realize it or not. It's the place where you react out of. It's the room out of which your life is lived deep down. In this room, there are things that are locked away, memories of things you love, the words of blessing that have been spoken over you and where you keep your dreams hidden. This inner room is the space where hope sits by the window and begins to grow, and where you keep those special sounds and smells and sights that make your heart skip a beat. You know this room? Maybe you've been there, maybe you've not. But there are other things in the room too. There are things shoved into the dark corners. There are skeletons hidden in the closet. There are words and pictures on the wall that are not so lovely In fact, this room also holds your pains and your hurts and your disappointments and your dashed hopes. On the wall hang the words you wish you could forget and the names that you've been called. And though hope does grow by the window, the fear and failure and anxiety and anger and resentment and bitterness grow like a black mold in the dark shadows. Jesus says this, not me. Jesus says that you live from your depths. You live from this room. This is why we're called to guard our hearts, because that's where the room is, and to make our body the temple of the Spirit of God, because it's where God dwells. This is why we invite Jesus into the holy space of our hearts. And when we invite him in there, we ask him to clean up the room. And whether you like it or not, you're living, speaking, acting from the overflow of this secret interior space. So here's why the unreflective life is dangerous. Because our behaviors are born from our depths. They come out of this room, and our sin festers and grows in the unexamined heart. And it blooms into destructive words, behavior, and actions. The powerful work of transformation happens when you open the room. When you open the room. When you open the room to Jesus. When you invite him into your heart, you invite him into that room. When you open the room to a friend or somebody else who can go into the room with you and go, "What is that in the corner? And isn't that beautiful?" The powerful work of surgery and transformation happens there as Jesus begins to do a renovation in your heart. In Christian circles, we talk about this idea of inviting Jesus into our heart. When I was a teenager, I asked Jesus into my heart. But then you know what I did? I put him in the closet. And I said, "You just stay there in the closet." And I locked him in. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I began to let Jesus out. And ever since then, he's been doing surgery on my heart. And there have been times when he's wanted to redecorate. And I've said, "No." And then I realized a couple years later, I should have let him redecorate. Can we do it now? And then it's more work, but we get at it. And what Jesus does is those words on the wall that are hurtful words that people said about me, Jesus takes those down. And he puts different words on the wall. And the pictures of the bad stuff from my past, he takes those pictures down. He puts those in the closet and says, "We don't need those anymore." And he says, "Let's put up the picture of the prodigal son instead." Jesus wants to redecorate the inner room of your heart. And he wants to remove the mold and the darkness and the hurtful things. And he wants to give you love and grace and truth and beauty. So when Jesus says those hard words that I read to you in the beginning about your actions and loving your enemies and all that kind of stuff and judgment, and all, it's because Jesus wants you to be the person he intended you to be. And he wants you to be free. And he wants you to make good choices that are loving and that are beautiful. But you can't keep living on the surface and never entering the room of your heart. And you can't do it alone. Don't do it alone. It's too scary. You have to do it with Jesus, first of all. This isn't self-help. You have to do it with Jesus first, and then you have to bring somebody else in there. Because you are the man. You are the woman. And Jesus doesn't say that in a condemning way. He says it in a forgiving, loving, transformational way. And so the practice is the practice of self-reflective prayer. Go into the room in prayer and invite Jesus to renovate your heart. I read you part of Psalm 51 a minute ago. That's what David is doing in Psalm 51. He's going into the room of his heart and saying, "Jesus, do your work. Show me. Turn me into the person you want me to be so that you can live from the depths of goodness." I'm going to tell you one quick story and then I'll be done. Years ago, I was pastoring a family in Ann Arbor. I was a pastor in Ann Arbor, and there was just this wonderful family. I got to know the three kids and the mom really well. The dad had died like 20 years before, tragically, when they were very young. And when that happened, something happened to the mom. Something broke in her mind. And she began to hoard things because she wanted to remember the memories. And then the hoarding became something more than just memories. And for years, their home became something that they didn't want to be in. They didn't want anybody else to be in. And I would visit them. And you've probably seen the television shows around this. I literally would have to walk through stacks of stuff at their home. The boys moved out and left mom for a while. They were angry. And there was a point that they came together as sons and the daughter, and they said, we have to face We have to face this. It's real. We can't ignore it anymore. You know, they were dealing, this was a grief thing, right? She went through terrible grief and loss, and something just, some of you have been through that, you know what that's like. Something broke. They ended up moving mom out into a condo, which was one of the healthiest things they ever did for her. She began to see some transformation. And then the boys did this. They both quit their jobs. They moved into back into that house that they had moved intentionally out of. And they spent 6 months every day going through every single paper and everything and throwing stuff away and cleaning stuff and keeping the good stuff and getting rid of the bad stuff. And they found some amazing stuff, let me tell you. They found some a design of a wooden boat that their dad had created on his own, and the wooden boat was in the backyard underneath a tarp, and they pulled it out, and here it was, this handmade wooden boat by their dad that had been sitting there for 20 years. Their mom's an incredible poet, one of the best poets I know, and they found stacks and stacks of her amazing poetry. There were beautiful things in that home, and there were some terrible things in that home. But here's what they had to do. They had to agree to go into the house. They had to agree to not do it alone. And they had to agree to examine and seek beauty and get rid of the darkness. Jesus is inviting you to that same place. When we talk about inviting, Jesus into our heart. Here's my question. Have you really invited him into your heart? Or have you shoved him under the bed with the monsters? Or into the closet with the garbage? Or have you invited Jesus to do the delicate surgery in your heart? Maybe you've heard this all your life and you're like, I've never actually done that. I do not want to miss this opportunity. If anything I'm saying is making sense to you and you've never invited Jesus into your heart, now's the time. Today's the day. There's no better time. In fact, we're going to have communion in a little bit, and I just want you to reflect. Is today the day? It's today the day that I open that door and say, Jesus, come in? Because there's a scripture in Revelation. I think it'll come up on the screen here. Scripture in Revelation that goes like this. Here I am, Jesus says. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in. I'll eat with that person. And they with me. Can you open the door? Can you open the door? Let's pray. Jesus, I want to thank you that you love us. You love us enough to say the hard words to us that I began with today. Father, when we are convicted by you, our natural tendency is to put up the shield of deflection. But Jesus, you invite us into a relationship that will never end and in which we will never be rejected. And so, Jesus, I pray that each one of us, whether it's inviting you into the room for the first time, whether we invited you in but we didn't know what it meant, whether we invited you in and then it got scary and we put you under the bed or into the closet, God, I pray that you would help us to open the room in our hearts and to be honest in self-examination and praying that you would do the renovation there. And I pray, God, that you would help us not to do that alone. God, give us courage. Give us courage. It is not wimpy to let someone into the interior of your heart. It's the most courageous thing that a person could ever do. And so I pray that you give us courage today to open the door of the hearts first to you and then to somebody else who loves you and loves us. Amen.